Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this tax day and speak with Frank Clementi, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness, who is the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Walmart on Tax Day: How Taxpayers Subsidize America's Biggest Employer and Richest Family. We'll discuss how America's richest family, the heirs of the founder of Walmart, avoid an estimated $609 million in taxes, and how Walmart, that had $15 billion in profits last year, receives an estimated $6.2 billion in taxpayer subsidies while avoiding an estimated $1 billion in federal taxes. Then, on the anniversary of the Boston bombing terrorist attack, we'll examine why white so-called Christians who engage in murderous attacks against other religious groups in America are not labeled terrorists. Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss the latest attack on a Jewish community center in Kansas in which three Christians were shot by a white supremacist who yelled, "Hail Hitler," a neo-Nazi who previously organized a Christian army with heavy weapons stolen from U.S. armories. Then finally, following Monday's bombing in Nigeria's capital, in which 71 died and 124 were injured, we will look into Tuesday's abduction of over 100 schoolgirls in Nigeria by the same Islamist insurgent group responsible for the bombing, Boko Haram, which translated means opposition to Western education. Anadi Okure, the executive director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, who is a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria, joins us to discuss the Nigerian government's failure to deal with this increasingly dangerous and destructive homegrown terrorist organization. And joining us now is Frank Clementi, who's the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations, and has also been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. He is the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Walmart on Tax Day: How Taxpayers Subsidize America's Biggest Employer and Richest Family. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Clementi.
Thank you, Ian.
And Walmart had $16 billion in profits last year on revenues of $473 billion. And if that, you would think, would be enough. But the Walton family, the heirs to the founder of Walmart, they have avoided an estimated $607 million in federal taxes. Walmart's avoided has been given $6.2 billion in federal subsidies, and they've avoided an estimated $1 billion in federal taxes each year. So having just written a check to the IRS, I'm kind of angry at this, to put it bluntly. How do they get away with it?
Well, unfortunately, it's the way our tax system's designed. The rich and powerful have lots of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and they hire these lobbyists to put all sorts of tax breaks and tax loopholes into the tax code, and it works to their advantage, unfortunately. And, we all have to come together and try and change that. That's what Americans for Tax Fairness is working to do.
Well, the six Walton heirs are the wealthiest family in America with a net worth of $148.8 billion. And so collectively they have more wealth than 49 million American families combined. So why should they then be avoiding, how do they avoid, just the personally, how do they avoid $607 million in federal taxes?
Well, that's unfortunately the way our tax system is structured right now, and it's one of the key things that we all have to work to change. Think back to Mitt Romney when he ran for president in 2012, and lots of people were astonished that he was paying a 14% tax rate. Whereas a lot of people who are middle class, they're paying a 25 or a 28% tax rate. You remember Warren Buffett talking about he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary pays. The reason that he is able to do that, and Mitt Romney was able to do it, and the Waltons are able to do it, is our tax system actually charges a lower tax rate for people who make their income from their investments on Wall Street. So if you're a middle class, upper middle class person, you're mostly making your income through your salary or through your wages. You are paying a higher tax rate than somebody who's mostly making their income by selling real estate or by trading stocks on Wall Street. That's the unfortunate design of our system right now. We've got to change it. We need to put it back in the balance. Back under Ronald Reagan, it was the same tax rate. If you were a billionaire and you were making your money from your salary or you were making it from your investments, you were paying the same tax rate. Now it's different. Now it's substantially, your tax rate is substantially lower if you're making your money off of your investments as opposed to off of wages.
But the Walton family own more than 50% of Walmart shares, so they're getting huge dividends every year, right? And the tax on dividends is what?
That's right. The tax on dividends is 20%, just like the tax on if you were to sell the stock is 20%.
Right.
So
right.
Dividends and stock sales are treated the same.
Right.
So that's what we've got to even those things out. They should be matching what the tax rate is that you pay on your wages and salaries.
So, Frank Clemente, let's talk then about how Walmart receives an estimated $6.2 billion annually in federal taxpayer subsidies.
Sure. So there was a study that was done a couple of years ago by a committee in Congress, and they found that the average cost of a Walmart employee that was being essentially picked up by the federal government was about a little over $4,000. And that is money that's being paid because Walmart is not paying a high enough wage. People are ending up having to go and receive food stamps so that they can feed their family. They're having to go on their state's Medicaid program in order to get health care coverage. If their kids go to a public school, they may be getting a school lunch program to subsidize, or they might be actually living in public housing, and so they're getting a subsidy to live in public housing. So this committee totaled up all of those costs for an average family, for an average Walmart employee. We took the midpoint of that cost, which is about $4,000, and we multiplied that times the number of employees Walmart has across the country. And so that gave us a state-by-state count on how much the taxpayer, and it's mostly the federal taxpayer, is subsidizing these Walmart stores. Think about it this way. Walmart just pays wages that are too low, and it provides benefits that are not nearly good enough, say, in the healthcare area. And so the workers have to make up the difference in order to, be able to survive, to have a living wage. And they do that by, availing themselves of federal programs that exist to help people essentially bring up their standard of living. This isn't to to a middle-class standard of living, by the way. This is simply to, being able to survive at barely above the poverty level. Another is the EITC. That's a subsidy that's given to workers because their employers are not paying them enough in wages, and it basically it's a tax break that the workers themselves get so that it makes it worthwhile for them to work. They're actually the low wages they get from the company, they can make up for it a little bit by getting a tax break. They don't have to pay taxes on those low wages that the companies get. So again, it's another taxpayer subsidy for Walmart and its employees.
And Walmart has 1.4 million employees. They're the largest private employer in the United States. Of course, they don't call them employees. They call them associates. And they're very good at public relations. By the way, Frank Clemente, let me reintroduce you. Frank Clemente is the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations, and has also been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. He's the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Walmart on Tax Day, How Taxpayers Subsidize America's Biggest Employer and Richest Family. So they're obviously good at public relations, and they'd rather put on ads on television showing their cheerful associates having a great job and et cetera, then actually pay them wages. So they do a lot of PR, and believe it or not, NPR did an incredible softball piece on them the other day. They had a reporter that went down to Walmart headquarters who was obviously completely snowed by the PR machine, and they went on about how much they save poor people money by having low prices. How do they justify it? I mean, How do this family wake up every day? And if they tried to spend the money they had, they couldn't in their lifetime probably. And yet, I don't know what they do in terms of philanthropy. It's not much. They know they're pushing for charter schools, which is not exactly in the public interest. So what's your understanding of why they'd rather do public relations than pay a little bit of extra to make their give their employees a livable wage and have a much better workplace environment, frankly?
Yeah, so I have to admit, I'm not an expert on Walmart's corporate practices, but, you know, much more on the tax side of things. But, you know, it's like they're the worst of employers in terms of their ability to extract every ounce of work at the lowest price from their employees, as well as from their suppliers. I mean, we all have read stories, and there's been lots of books analyzing how Walmart, how demanding they are of the companies that supply them with the product, squeezing the lowest possible cost out of those companies. It's their business model. So their business model is lowest cost because they want to have the biggest market share, and that means for them having the lowest prices as opposed to the best services. Lowest prices means paying the lowest wages they can possibly pay and still keeping people employed. As we know, we have a struggling economy, especially in rural America and in some of the poorest urban areas of our country. And people will take whatever wages they can get in order to make it in this day and age, and even if it means they're working 20 or 30 hours. We know a lot of Walmart employees don't get to work a full-time job. They get to work part-time. They keep them their shift constantly moving. They never give them kind of standard days and hours. All of it's to keep the employees on their toes and to feel as least comfortable as possible in that job. As you know, there's been a long-range campaign by the United Food and Commercial Workers to try and work with Walmart employees to try and help them get into a union. And Walmart is the most virulent anti-union company in the country. They've got huge corporate lobbies, or corporate lawyers, big law firms to help them protect them against unionizing. There was one place where they actually organized the part of the grocery section of Walmart a bunch of years ago, and I know they actually shut down that location because they're so anti-union.
Well, Frank Clementi, we know that a lot of their employees are on food stamps, not to mention don't get sufficient health coverage, and so that they go on the public dime whenever they get sick as well. But one of the ironies is that Walmart benefits from the taxpayer-funded public assistance programs because they help pump up their sales. Walmart has an estimated $13.5 billion in food stamp sales last year. So they're directly benefiting from the very program that their own employees have to participate in because they're not being paid sufficient wages.
Yes, that was the irony. I had no idea. What we found was that one out of $5 that the food stamp program spends actually goes into Walmart's is Walmart sale. The reason we discovered this was we were reading some of their corporate documents that are filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. We discovered in there it said that there will be a material effect on Walmart's business and on its profits if these budget cuts go through in Congress, reducing food stamp spending.
Well, aren't we lucky we have them as an ally?
We are, right. I mean, we went through this big fight this year where, you know, the Republicans were trying to cut $40 billion out of the food stamp program. They ended up cutting $8 billion out of it, which was really very hurtful for the people who depend on this program. I mean, so in some ways, Walmart is an ally on increasing, keeping food stamp spending higher. By the same token, you can see it's an ally on both sides of that equation, right? One is continue food stamp spending at a robust rate so that people come in and buy food from us. At the same time, their employees can use or make available the food stamp program because Walmart's not paying them enough. So it's hard to look at. I mean, we want food stamps for people. People need food support. So I don't want to knock that program, but what I really want to do is knock Walmart for paying a low wage that people are able to qualify for the program.
Well, Frank Clementi, again, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness and lead author of the new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Walmart on Tax Days, How Taxpayers Subsidize America's Biggest Employer and Richest Family. Just turning back to Walmart's avoiding taxes, they apparently avoiding an estimated $1 billion in federal taxes by using tax breaks and loopholes and including a strategy known as accelerated depreciation. So walk us through that. And also the other thing, just in the last couple of minutes here, that the Walton family is avoiding an estimated $3 billion in taxes using specialized trusts to dodge estate taxes.
Yeah, so everybody thinks that the official federal corporate income tax rate is 35%. And as people are probably aware, there's a big campaign going on in the country by corporate America, by big corporations that are claiming the U.S. tax rate is too high, we can't compete with other countries abroad, and we need to lower the tax rate. And we know through this report and through other reports, Citizens for Tax Justice just put out a major report that looked at 200 of the 80 most profitable Fortune 500 companies. And that report found that the effective corporate tax rate, in other words, the rate that companies actually pay, not what the official rate is, but what they actually pay because of all the tax breaks, the tax loopholes that they're able to take advantage of, is more like 19%. So that's 35% is the official rate, but the big Fortune 500 companies are paying 19%. And many of those companies are actually paying less to countries abroad where they make profits. So Walmart is able to, like a lot of big companies, is able to use loopholes that are in the tax system to reduce their corporate tax rate. And that's why they're reducing it down to about 29%. It's still quite a bit lower than the 35% rate, but I have to admit it's a little bit better than a lot of these big companies that are mostly sheltering their income in tax havens abroad. Walmart does not do much of that because largely it's a U.S. company, and it just can't shift its money around to these other countries. On the estate tax question, there was this Bloomberg News that really broke this story about a year ago or so. They took a look at the biggest Walmart estate tax trust that has been set up. And what they found is that they are very aggressively using this trust. And it appears to them that the way their lawyers have structured this trust, they will be able to pay absolutely no estate tax on the money that's in that trust. Normally, the tax rate on a trust would be 40% for everything that's over $5 million or so. Their trust, the one that they looked at, has, I forget what it was, I think it was at least $2 billion in it. And they're estimating, so normally you'd be able to pay 40% of $9 billion. So normally 40% of $9 billion would be, about $3 billion or so in taxes, estate taxes. We believe that they're going to be able to avoid, the big one, they're going to be able to avoid all of that estate tax, and that they've got, I think it's 20 or 30 trusts that they've set up, and presumably they're using this very aggressive estate tax accounting on all these trusts. This Bloomberg story said there's no other estate that is using such aggressive tax avoidance schemes as Walmart is using. The Waltons are using.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Frank Clementi. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ian. Cheers.
Cheers. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Clementi, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. And he's also been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. He's the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Walmart on Tax Day, How Taxpayers Subsidize America's Biggest Employer and Richest Family.
If I were a rich man, all day long I biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bitty, bitty rich idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into why white so-called Christians who engage in murderous attacks against other religious groups in America are not labeled terrorists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And this latest shooting by an extremist here in the United States, where the extremist was captured on television shouting Heil Hitler after he'd shot Christians, as it hasn't happened, at a Jewish center. It's already, the feds are already stepping in, looking into the aspects of hate crime. But just for the benefit of our audience, Brian, I mean, isn't this terrorism? I mean, it's obviously a hate crime motivated by hatred. But it seems, you know, to also, we never really talk about Christian terrorism. Not that this guy was necessarily a Christian. But I'm wondering, you know, why it is that most of the charges against him, except for the feds, just business as usual in terms of criminology. This feels more like a political crime to me than a run-of-the-mill murder.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that, you know, I'm going to do is just tell you how the feds make their decision. If it's a domestic extremist that is not acting on behalf of a larger conspiracy or group, they will formulaically charge it as a hate crime. And so what happens is, because they have a working rule on how they operate, that this distinction is often something that the public takes some issue with. In any event, the fact of the matter is the penalties are going to be the same. That is, when a death results from a hate crime such as this, the death penalty comes into play. And that would be the case if this person was charged under terrorism laws, which are generally prosecuted, again, with regard to those who are acting in support of some larger entity.
So would you accept the premise, Brian, that we, you know, we talk about Muslim and Islamic terrorism all the time, but we don't, we seem to be very nervous about describing Christian terrorism, and there's been a number of incidents of it, not the least of which was in a church in Oklahoma, where an abortion doctor was killed in the name of Christianity. I just, you know, since the word terrorism is bandied about so much and it carries so much weight and such a strong stigma, it feels like we're letting a lot of our terrorists off the hook.
That may very well be right. In this case, he actually has criticized Christianity. So for this particular individual, he's probably more of a Christian identity-oriented fellow, which pretty much rejects Christianity. He certainly in his writings has criticized Christianity, but he has used words like starting a Christian army. But his definition of Christian is so far removed from mainstream Christianity that most often people don't do that. Now, to the extent that we have perhaps a double standard in when we have Salafist jihadists acting in a manner that is anathema to mainstream Muslims here in the United States, I think you make an excellent point. And that was something I tried to make with Bill Maher last year, who painted all Muslims the same with respect to their interpretation of scripture. So I think, again, as you continually do, make an excellent point that in the way that we designate these, that there is a degree of inconsistency when it comes to white domestic extremists versus Middle East extremists who are lumped into being called Muslim. If I may also say, many of the people who are labeled as Muslim extremists are oftentimes folks who are, again, on the fringe. They're recent converts. They're people who have mental illnesses. They're people who are sociopaths who bounced into this orbit and in prior generations may have gone to another antisocial extremist ideology, but just happened to be ensnared here. And I think what we end up doing, as I think you are alluding to, is creating a situation where we're causing fear of mainstream Muslims across the United States, millions of whom are completely law-abiding and whose version of Islam is not at all threatening in the least.
So then perhaps, Brian, we're attributing too much to this fellow. Maybe he's just not particularly bright. I recall there was also another shooting in Wisconsin at a Sikh temple where this white supremacist shot a bunch of Sikhs thinking that they were Muslims. And in this case, presumably he thought the people that he shot were Jews, given that he was clearly has a poisonous anti-Semitic background. But his membership in Nazi groups goes back to, 1976, when he was still in the army, and he did two tours in Vietnam. And then he got into a violent battle in 1979 in Greensboro, North Carolina, with Nazis and Klan members on one side and communists on the other, that left five of his adversaries dead. It's amazing this guy is still walking around. I mean, what happened? Did he do time?
Not in that one, and I don't believe he necessarily fired any shots in that particular attack. Even if he did, all of the folks that were charged and prosecuted in that particular 1979 incident were acquitted. And I mean, if there is a guy who had hit the lottery with respect to his commission of crimes relative to the time served, I think Miller, who I knew him as, that was his name when I was tracking him in the 1980s, really did hit that jackpot. He could have spent basically a lifetime in prison. He cut a deal with the feds after going underground, declaring war on the federal government, Jews and others, and he kept these arsenals of sophisticated military weapons. By his own admission, when he was arrested, he had C4s and all kinds of military heavy weaponry. Prior to that, he even had anti-tank rockets, law anti-tank rockets. So this is a guy who actually, the biggest punishment for him was the fact that he was exiled by the movement that once embraced him. Because once he became a state witness, he only served 3 years in prison out of five for cutting that deal, which, by the way, all the defendants in the trials that he was involved with as a witness also were acquitted. I don't want to say it's a comedy of errors, because it's not. This was a terrible thing all the way around. But this was someone who was exiled, you know, by his community, made some inroads over the last decade with certain pockets of the hate world, and was notorious with regard to making thousands of posts on the internet. But he really ceased to be a leader with this world that had collapsed on him based on him being a witness. Prior to that, he really was a pioneer. And just briefly, he was one of the key folks who Nazified the Klan, who militarized the Klan. As you said, spoke of raising a Christian army to declare war on the United States. He got $200,000 from a group called the Order, which committed a laundry list of crimes, including a multi-million-dollar armored car heist. So in the 80s, he really was at the center of much of the hate activity that was going on at the time, yet like a musical artist or a ball player that hits his zenith in one decade and then in subsequent decades is barely heard from again. I think that's what happened. And I think because he was exiled and because he wasn't taken as seriously as he was heretofore, perhaps this attack was really one final whimper of trying to gain relevancy, legitimacy, or rehabilitation in a world that really had abandoned him.
Well, Brian Levin, though, it's hardly a coincidence that he's caught by the feds with lots of military weapons, which were clearly stolen from military arsenals, and he's trying to form a Christian army at the same time. And the order, the group that you mentioned, not only did they do the $3.6 million Brinks armored car heist in Ukiah, California, they also shot, of course, the Denver radio host, Alan Berg, did they not, in 1984?
Yes. You know, by some counts, these folks committed scores of crimes. And there is a debate whether or not he was actually a member of the order, though not involved in its central core, or whether he was merely a beneficiary of the order. Either way, we know for a fact that he met with Robert Matthews, who was the leader of the order, who died in a fiery shootout with the FBI in Washington State in the mid-'80s. Miller was someone who, frankly, would have been much more likely to have committed something like this in 1986, 85, or 87 than today. He was someone who all of us in the hate monitoring community knew. We saw his posts, but I think many people thought that he was virtually irrelevant, which ironically might have been the catalyst to him going out and doing this. A guy like him in his 70s, who once headed groups that had 1,000 members, now living, you know, in rural Missouri without a following, really, this was, I think, an attempt to define his legacy, and with tragic result.
Well, clearly, Brian Levin, this fellow's stature in the hate world was damaged by the plea bargain that he did with the U.S. government. He also ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010 and received 7 votes. So his political career wasn't exactly a successful one. But, you know, both of us had to sort of, we have to sort of pinch ourselves here for not laughing at the absurdity of this all, but this is lethal absurdity. Lives were lost, you know. This fellow, of course, had access to firearms. It's amazing that he was able to buy the weapons used in this murder, apparently, from a straw buyer. So, again, you know, you're left with the recognition and the realization, surely, Brian Levin, that one, you know, the FBI, for as much as it does infiltrate these groups, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, I know, gives the FBI an awful lot of information to act on, but they're still these guys are able to create mayhem, and they're able to get weapons. I mean, that's a pretty lethal combination, isn't it?
And if I could compliment you as one of the voices of folks who has warned against far right-wing extremists. I'm not talking about conservative people of goodwill here who we might debate from time to time. I'm talking about the hardcore, violent, radical right-wing extremists is a danger in the United States. And certainly, federal law enforcement knows this now, and they are taking significant measures to stop this. With respect to another point that you are making, you are 110% correct. And that is these folks who are often almost comical in their presentation represent one of the most significant domestic terrorism risks, as well as being among the least likely to capture and deter. Violent, hateful loners like Cross or Miller, as we used to call him, can do massive damage, and I'm talking not just killing a small number of people, but dozens or more, with relative ease based on the information that's available within their communities and on the internet. And I think that's one thing that that we worry about and that we consistently plan for, and that is a loner, smaller, autonomous cell, and that's coming across a broad spectrum that includes extreme radical Salafists or others, to commit mass terrorism on a much more significant scale. Look at what we're observing today with respect to Boston. Believe it or not, that Boston tragedy with respect to fatalities could have been much, much worse. And that is what we really, I think, have to pay attention to. And again, something that you have so credibly have done is pointed to this risk, which comes from the extreme radical right. We can laugh about these people. We can say, oh, okay, this guy did a terrible thing. But there is a significant risk that is even worse than what we saw in Overland Park, Kansas, over the weekend. And we continue to worry about it. And it's something, as I said, that is difficult to deter and something that does require some significant resources. And I applaud you for, again, paying attention to this issue, because I think a lot of people shrug it off when they shouldn't.
Well, Brian Levin, it's a phenomenon, isn't it? Your previous employers, the Southern Poverty Law Center, they have counted 939 hate groups in the United States in 2013. And the federal government statistics show that there were 5,796 hate crimes reported in the United States in 2012. 1,166 were committed on the basis of religion, with 59.7%. Or 674 anti-Jewish, and as it happens, with no fatalities. So this is not an isolated incident. This problem has metastasized in our society. And how do you root it out, do you think?
First of all, excellent point. One of the things that I think is so interesting is hate crime, most of which are committed by young males or young male adults, has actually gone down, because a lot of the loose cherries were shaken off the tree with the passage of these statutes throughout the United States. And people who have relatively shallow bigotry, in other words, they go out as part of a group for excitement and they get drunk, are less likely to go out and commit these things. What we now see is a remaining core of folks. And even that 939 number of hate groups is a decline from the last couple of years when the number of hate groups peaked. Nevertheless, what I think where there is a real risk is not in this kind of thousands of hate crimes which we see every year, which are terrible. I think the risk that we see is something that you had alluded to in your previous question, which is, what are we going to do with the next fellow who does not just kill a few people, or is not just caught in a plot or an attempt, but actually is able to carry out a mass attack which kills many more? And that's what we really worry about. Yes, there is the continuing terrible existence of hate crimes, but we're really near 14-year lows with respect to reported hate crimes, or 15-year lows. And that, unfortunately, continues, and it ebbs and flows. And we have to respond to that. But what I think we continue to worry about is, having a domestic Andres Breivik over here in the United States, or another Timothy McVeigh.
Well, Breivik, of course, killed, almost 100 people, and methodically and hideous. So, but that's not to say that this guy didn't end up with assault rifles and C4 plastic explosives. He had the potential, in many times in his past, has had the potential to do enormous damage.
By all means. And we see these kind of plots happen quite a bit. One of his pen pals wanted to blow up a Martin Luther King Day celebration in 2011, which could have killed scores of people or injured many people. So we see plots, we see examples of people who had some kind of sophistication. This fellow Miller is an Army veteran. These people have the motive, the opportunity, and at least the training, and it's a lot of times it's just a matter of dumb luck or timing that more people weren't killed, including over the weekend. And we're really worried about that. When is the next extremist going to hit that fatal hockey puck through the goal and kill many more And I don't mean to minimize what has happened, but those of us in the monitoring community really do gird for this because we are seeing plots, and I don't want to go into detail, that could result in a massive loss of life.
Well, Brian, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
As always, thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the bombing in Nigeria and the abduction of schoolgirls by Boko Haram.
Some bread, hey-ya! Someone nearly died, hey-ya! Someone just died, hey-ya! Police they come, army they come, hey-ya! Confusion everywhere, seven minutes later, all don't cool down, brother, police don't go away, army don't disappear, them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anyede Akuri, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He's a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States, and is co-author with Dean Hoge of International Priests in America, Challenges and Opportunities, and African and Caribbean Catholics in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anyede.
Thank you very much.
So it seems that things are starting to get to, I don't know whether you could say it's falling apart, but there's been some really extreme violence now in Nigeria. Just a few days ago, 71 people were killed in a bus station on the outskirts of Abuja, and that shocked everybody in Nigeria, and the Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, visited the bombing site where bodies were scattered everywhere. But now, following that now, we've had this kidnapping of, some reports say, of up to 200 schoolgirls have been abducted, probably, I think, by the extremist group Boko Haram. Is that your understanding?
Yes. There have been information coming out of Nigeria reporting earlier that there were over 200. And just this afternoon, the number has been revised downwards to about 150 because they said some of the girls escaped and ran home. So they have found some of them. But right now, there are still over 100 girls unaccounted for. And the school, unfortunately, is in an area that is close to the forest regions where Boko Haram has been very active in killing people and destabilizing the community. And also, it's understood that their school had been closed, but they were just reopening it for a few days to allow their girls go and take their final exam. And so while they were doing that, this disaster struck and the girls are kidnapped.
Now, would the objective of Boko Haram kidnapping these girls, first of all, Boko Haram itself, I think if you translate it, doesn't it mean against Western education
is forbidden.
Yeah, Western education is forbidden. So that's how they label themselves. So is that why they're attacking these girls, because they're getting a Western education?
They're getting a Western education, which for them is an abomination. Girls should not be educated. In fact, this is a group that was founded in 2002, And then they carried out initially a program which they described as the propagation of the prophet's teaching, meaning Muhammad, and jihad. And so initially they focused on opposing Western education, and so they saw the education of girls especially as forbidden by their own brand of religion, because that is not true of Islam itself. And so they started attacking primary schools, attacking schools nearby them, and they're seeing the whole education process as, quote, against their own beliefs. So they have been very particularly against the education of girls. So they have been attacking that, and now they are not only attacking girls' schools, they attack boys' schools too. Previously, they had attacked boys' secondary schools and killed over 50 of the students who were studying in this boarding school. So their primary objective in this case is to ensure that these girls don't get educated, and the boys who get educated, for them, should be educated in Quranic schools. Anything else is contrary to what they're trying to propose. And the same group has also tried to impose Sharia law on the states around where they are carrying on the activities. So it's really a group that is trying to destabilize the country, that is trying to edge out people who don't believe what they believe, Christians and other Muslims alike.
Again, I'm speaking with Anedi Okure, who is the executive director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. Initially were talking about Monday's explosion at a commuter bus station in Nigeria's capital, where 71 people were killed and 124 people were injured. And that was followed now by the kidnapping of about 150 schoolgirls who have been abducted. Now, the bombing of the bus station, that's the first time Boko Haram has struck in the nation's capital, at least, for 2 years?
Yeah, since the bombing of the UN building. And actually, there had been previous attempts. They were foiled, trying to destabilize even Independence Day celebration. And at one point, they tried to attack the convoy of some of the nation's officials, but those attempts were foiled. So since that, successful bombing of the UN building in Abuja, and of course, the one that they struck at Christmas in 2011, that one was closer to Abuja too. But this is the first time that they have carried out such a massive attack within the nation's capital. And unfortunately for them, I don't know how they're going to win sympathy with this kind of brutal action on innocent civilians. People were lining up in the morning to go to work, some to board the bus and go travel to their homes. And they went in there, just carried out this massive bombing and killing dozens and dozens, as you mentioned so far, 71 people dead. And those in the hospital, some are critically injured. Nobody knows, there might be even more death. So this kind of behavior is making it extremely difficult for people to sympathize with their cause, number one. And secondly, they are not even willing to sit around the table and discuss their grievances, but they go attacking babies, innocent children in school, people going into the church to worship, people standing at the bus station to get into buses and travel. And yet, the people that they should go and discuss with, they don't do it. It seems seems that it's a calculated attempt to just destabilize the country. It's difficult to explain it otherwise, because if one has grievances, he said, okay, let's sit and talk about it. What do you want? Let's negotiate. But I'm unwilling, absolutely unwilling to do that. And sometimes some of them that are taken into custody, before we know it, they go into the jail, attack the jail guards, kill them, and release their members. So even trying to detain them and discuss and find out what they want becomes even a precarious venture to do so.
So, Anede Okure, tell me then, what can be done? Obviously, you know, we've had this war on terror, and at the time that George W. Bush declared it, a lot of people thought that was something of an absurdity to declare war on a tactic. And it seems like this is being repeated to some extent in Nigeria, where President Goodluck Jonathan has placed the three northeastern states under a state of emergency since May of last year, and apparently the military have been bombing along the border with Cameroon, where the Boko Haram hideouts are supposed to be. Is there a military solution to this? It doesn't sound like anybody has managed to, the Nigerian military has, and after all, a lot of Nigeria's recent leaders came out of the military. So why have they been unable to stop this insurgency?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. In fact, that's at the core of this issue. Why is it that Nigeria has been able to stop this insurgency? First of all, I think that there was a big delay by the government in terms of addressing Boko Haram from the early stages, because it started as a grievance just locally. And unfortunately, the way initially the local police handled the situation wasn't in the best interest of what you call in terms of human rights violations, you know. So that was there. But then it was allowed a long time for it to regroup, for it to recruit disgruntled young men who are jobless, for it to even have cross-border recruits and interest. So that the government is to blame for that. Secondly, is there a military solution to this? It is really difficult. I am basically opposed to using the strong arm of the military as a hammer to find peace. I'm opposed to that. And we at AFJN are opposed to that. However, in this case, is that you have people who are fighting and killing innocent people, who are attacking schools, churches, and some mosques, who are killing people at bus stations, who are destabilizing the country, and who have been made several offers to come to the table and have peace talks, and have absolutely refused to do so. So in that case, what do you do? It seems that military engagement is an option, although it's not the best, but it seems that the government is left with no other option except to engage in military fashion. That's the first point. The second point is that it seems also that even with that option, the government is not doing enough in terms of mobilizing the military. They know the region where they are. I know there are some informants within the community that are difficult to find out, but they know the camps are in the forest, they know where they are, and they could easily get a surveillance to find it out. I think the impression that most people get in Nigeria is that the government is not doing enough. And incidentally, former President Olusegun Obasanjo had written a much debated and controversial letter to the current president, accusing him of a lot of things. And one of the things in that letter, rightly or wrongly, is that he accused him of being weak and not responding to the Boko Haram situation in the right manner and containing it. So while one might have disagreement as to the tone of the letter, it is interesting that former president, who is, as they call it in Nigeria, the godfather of this current president, is turning around to accuse him of being weak, of not responding appropriately, of not containing Boko Haram. It makes you wonder what the real issues are in this case. There is also the other accusations that there are elements, political elements, who are sponsors of this Boko Haram, and that it seems that the intelligence community know about it, but because they are big elephants, or what you call it, sacred cows in the political arena, that they are not willing to bring that out in the open.
So you're saying that there are people, powerful and wealthy people, inside the Nigerian government establishment or business community that are supporting these terrorists who are kidnapping schoolgirls and blowing up people at bus stations? I would have thought maybe they were getting outside support from maybe Saudi Arabia or somewhere like that, but that's pretty shocking. Is this widely discussed in Nigeria?
Yeah, it's been discussed. In fact, even at one point early last year, or was it late 2012, President Jonathan said, quote, that there are elements, you know, sponsors of Boko Haram, you know, in high places. So that was a pretty grim statement for a president to make. So that has been said and has been discussed. And as I said, Boko Haram now has external connections, but initially it started in Nigeria. It's a domestic affair, it's a domestic issue. And in fact, we were one of those organizations that opposed to Boko Haram being labeled a foreign terrorist organization. Because at that time we said, look, this is a homegrown disgruntled group, deal with it that way. So we sent a letter to the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, dissuading her from labeling Boko Haram a foreign terrorist organization. I know he's been given that status now, but we were opposed to it precisely because at the time it was a strongly homegrown organization with sponsors within. Now there are external connections, but this is a much later development.
Well, Anede Okorie, I think we have to do a follow-up and follow this story some more, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Anede Okorie, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.